I want you to picture this. It's 2016, and Sterling Infrastructure is, well, they're actively losing money. And they're losing it doing what they've always done, paving state highways.
Right, which is just a brutally tough business model to begin with.
Oh, absolutely. But then you fast forward to today. That exact same firm is throwing off adjusted EBITDA margins north of 20%. I mean,
Right.
they're operating as a virtual monopoly on the ground beneath big tech's most secretive AI data centers.
Yeah, contrast is really staggering, especially for, an institutional investor who is used to modeling traditional engineering and construction firms.
Exactly. So that's the mission for today's deep dive into your stack of research. We're pulling from notes by William Blair, Sidoti, Stifel, D.A. Davidson, and a really incredible trove of primary AlphaSense expert transcripts. We're going to unpack how a dirt-moving company engineered one of the most brilliant business model pivots of the decade.
Because it really is a masterclass, isn't it? It's about capital allocation, strategic de-risking, and at its core, the monetization of complex logistics in a totally supply-constrained niche.
Yes, exactly. But to understand the fortress they've built today around the hyperscaler build-out, we really have to start with what they actively tore down. I mean, we need to talk about the legacy business.
Right, the great pivot. Because back in 2016, a staggering 79% of Sterling's revenue, and actually previously it had been up to 95%, came from what the industry calls low-bid, heavy highway projects.
Which, reading through the sell-side reports, is universally acknowledged as just a structurally flawed economic model.
Oh, it's notoriously difficult. I mean, in the heavy highway space, contractors are typically dealing with the Department of Transportation. So the DOT provides engineering plans that might only be maybe 60 or 70% complete.
Wow, that's it, just a partial blueprint.
Yeah, exactly. And then contractors are forced to bid a fixed price contract based on those incomplete plans. And of course, the absolute lowest bidder wins the job.
So the winner is essentially the firm that is willing to assume the maximum amount of blind execution risk.
That's exactly what it is. You're holding the bag on all the operational unknowns.
Yeah.
If you hit unexpected bedrock, or if a weather system parks over your site for 3 weeks,
Or the cost of diesel spikes.
right, you just eat the loss.
Right.
Because the sole competitive differentiator in that bidding room is price, margins are naturally driven to the absolute floor before a single shovel even hits the dirt. I mean, gross margins in Sterling's legacy business were sitting around 6% in 2016.
6%. Man, listening to this, it just reminds me of a ruthless portfolio manager staring down a severely underperforming book.
No, that's a great analogy.
Right. Like you have these high beta, low conviction, cyclical positions, the highway contracts, and instead of trying to, marginally improve them, the management team just aggressively dumped them. They went all in on a secular compounder.
They did. They didn't just trim the low-bid highway work, they gutted it. Today, that segment is down to just 9% of revenue. They executed this brilliant addition by subtraction strategy.
So what did they replace it with?
Well, they shifted into alternative delivery transportation projects, and crucially, they pivoted aggressively into e-infrastructure.
Okay, let's talk about the alternative delivery part first, because that seems vital for the financial models.
It is. Instead of taking incomplete plans and bidding a fixed price, alternative delivery like design-build contracts brings the contractor into the engineering phase.
Oh, so they actually helped design the project.
Exactly. Which means they can identify the risks early, price them into the contract, and include mechanisms to pass inflation costs back to the client.
Which immediately changes the margin profile. But the real star of the show, the secular compounder here, is e-infrastructure. I mean, that segment now accounts for about 60% of their sales and a massive 75% of their operating income.
Right, because this wasn't just chasing a new market. It was a fundamental shift from competing on price to competing on execution. And that shift drove blended gross margins from that roughly 6% in 2016 to an incredible 23% by 2025.
Okay, we see the margin expansion, but for someone modeling this from, a desk in Manhattan, I want to ground this in physical reality
Sure.
because the term e-infrastructure sounds like server racks, cooling systems, fiber optic cables, but Sterling isn't a tech company. What is
Yeah.
the actual physical activity happening on these job sites?
The reality is intensely physical, and it's incredibly heavy. I mean, before a hyperscaler like Google, Meta, or Microsoft can stand up an AI data center, someone has to take 100 acres of uneven, raw, potentially hostile terrain
Okay.
and turn it into a perfectly flat, structurally sound pad. So Sterling does the heavy land clearing, they blast the bedrock, they handle deep soil stabilization, massive excavation, and they build this this labyrinth of underground duct banks required for the immense electrical and liquid cooling loads.
And their scope of work ends exactly when the concrete foundation is poured, right? They just prep the canvas and step away.
Exactly. Management often describes it as moving mountains. They are literally taking topographies that are entirely unsuited for advanced tech infrastructure and beating the earth into submission so the vertical construction can actually begin.
Which brings up the multi-billion dollar question for me. I mean, I have to play the skeptic here.
Go for it.
If the core physical activity is moving dirt, blasting rock, and digging holes, how on earth is a market pricing this company with a mid-teens multiple? Dirt moving is about as old economy as it gets. Why are they generating software like EBITDA margins on earthworks?
It's a great question. And the premium valuation is anchored in a concept Sterling's management calls fungibility.
Fungibility. Okay, unpack that for me.
It's the core of their capital agility.
Yeah.
So think about the physical assets, the fleet of massive excavators, the specialized bulldozers, and the human engineering expertise required to prep a 100-acre site for a hyperscale data center. Mm. Those exact same machines and those exact same crews are required to prep a site for a massive electric vehicle battery plant, or a million-square-foot pharmaceutical manufacturing lab, or a next-generation semiconductor fab.
Ah, so the underlying dirt doesn't care if the structure going on top of it will manufacture microchips or route AI queries.
You know, exactly. The prep work is identical. Hmm. Look at an automotive manufacturer. If they want to shift production from internal combustion sedans to electric SUVs, they face hundreds of millions of dollars in factory retooling costs.
Right. They have to halt production, redesign the assembly line. It's a nightmare.
But Sterling faces zero retooling costs. None. They don't have to retrain a single heavy equipment operator. They can dynamically pivot their massive operational capacity toward whichever high-growth, macro-driven end market is deploying the most capital at that moment.
Wow. So they just capture the secular tailwinds, the AI build-out, the reshoring of American manufacturing, electrification, completely insulated from the specific technology risks of any single sector.
Precisely. If a specific AI chip design fails, the data center still needs to be built for the next one.
Okay, but even with that fungibility, you know, a skeptic would point out that the barrier to entry for renting earth-moving equipment isn't exactly insurmountable. If the margins are this rich, why aren't well-capitalized regional contractors or private equity-backed roll-ups just flooding the zone and underbidding them?
Well, the moat here is multi-layered, and the first layer is just pure brute force scale.
Okay.
To even receive an invitation to bid on one of these mega projects, a contractor needs a balance sheet that eliminates 90% of the industry right out of the gate. The Stiefel research actually quantifies this beautifully.
What's the number?
To break ground on a typical hyperscale campus prep job, a firm needs roughly $200 million in heavy equipment assets already owned and deployed, plus another $50 million in working capital just to float the initial phases.
Wow. $250 million just to start. That thins the herd immediately. You can't just lease a dozen excavators from Caterpillar and show up to bid on an Amazon data center.
No, you absolutely cannot. Scale is just the ante to sit at the table. But the true competitive moat, the reason they command such a premium, is the mathematics of schedule assurance.
Schedule assurance. This concept dominated the AlphaSense expert transcripts. I mean, former project managers kept hammering on how site development is universally feared as the most unpredictable phase of construction.
Right, because once the concrete slab is poured, the general contractor knows exactly how many structural steel beams, how many bolts, and how many labor hours it will take to finish the building. The variables are controlled.
But the dirt work is the wild card.
Exactly. You're fighting subterranean surprises, geotechnical instabilities, weather patterns, and the compounding effect of a delay at the dirt phase is brutal for a developer's internal rate of return.
Yeah, one of the transcripts noted that a 2-week delay during site prep doesn't just push the ribbon cutting back 2 weeks. It throws off the mobilization schedule for every single subcontractor stacked up behind them.
Right. The steel guys, the framing crews, the electricians, they all have other jobs. If the site isn't ready on Tuesday, they might not be able to come back for 3 months. So a 2-week hiccup on the dirt can cascade into a 6-month delay for the entire billion-dollar asset.
And now view that cascade through the lens of a hyperscaler. These tech giants are locked in an arms race to deploy AI compute capacity. Their absolute constraints are time and power, not price.
Exactly. The site preparation phase typically represents less than 10% of the total project cost.
So if you're greenlighting a billion-dollar data center campus, the dirt work is maybe $50 to $80 million of the budget.
Right. So put yourself in the CFO's chair. Are you going to risk a six-month delay on a billion-dollar revenue-generating asset just to save $3 million by hiring an unproven regional excavator who came in with a lower bid?
It is financially irrational.
Totally irrational. Hyperscalers will happily pay a 5% to 8% premium to Sterling because Sterling owns the equipment outright, controls the specialized labor force, and has a proven resume of delivering these exact topographies ahead of schedule.
So they aren't really selling earthworks. They are selling an insurance policy against delayed compute time.
That's it. They are monetizing certainty. And there's an additional really critical layer to this moat that's surfaced repeatedly in the expert network calls, which is safety metrics.
Oh, right. Because in the mission critical space, a single fatality or catastrophic injury can permanently halt a project.
Yes, it triggers massive investigations and causes severe reputational damage to these highly visible, publicly traded tech giants. The hyperscalers audit the safety records of their contractors obsessively.
So Sterling's safety record is basically an impenetrable barrier.
Exactly. A private equity firm could theoretically buy $200 million of equipment tomorrow, but they cannot buy a decade-long track record of keeping hundreds of workers safe while blasting bedrock on complex high-pressure sites. If your safety metrics don't meet the hyperscaler's internal threshold, your bid goes straight in the trash.
Man, Sterling clearly has a commanding lead. They control the equipment, the safety resume, the schedule assurance. But instead of just harvesting the cash flow from that lead in Q3 of 2025, they aggressively widen the perimeter.
Right. They bought the very next bottleneck in the supply chain.
Let's look at the mechanics of that deal. Sterling acquired CEC Facilities Group for $505 million. That was structured as $450 million in cash and $55 million in stock.
And they paid roughly a 10x EBITDA multiple, which is nicely accretive considering Sterling trades at a premium to that.
Yeah, but the financial arbitrage is really secondary to the operational logic here. I mean, this deal is entirely about shifting from sequential construction to parallel construction.
Yes, because mega projects have historical choke points. For hyperscalers, the top two bottlenecks have consistently been site preparation and complex electrical infrastructure. And traditionally, the construction schedule forces these to happen sequentially.
Right, one after the other.
Exactly. Sterling would move the mountains, install the initial underground utility duct banks, pack up their equipment, and demobilize. And only after they left the site would the massive electrical contractors mobilize their own trailers, crews, and equipment to start pulling wire.
Which is a wildly inefficient handoff. It's like building a transcontinental railroad, but forcing the crew laying the wooden ties to completely finish 100 miles, pack up all their gear, and go home before the crew with the steel rails is even allowed to step onto the dirt.
That is exactly what it's like. And the downtime during that transition is measured in weeks. But by bringing CEC inside the tent, Sterling integrates premium electrical, mechanical, and plumbing services directly with their heavy site development.
So they don't have to wait for the handoff.
No. They can install complex underground electrical conduits and vault systems while the heavy earth moving is still happening on the other side of the pad.
They own the track and the train. They coordinate the entire dance. And, you know, the William Blair analysts specifically modeled this integration. They pointed out that running these massive work streams in parallel has the potential to shave 1 to 2 entire months off a data center build timeline.
Which is huge, giving a hyperscaler an extra 60 days of AI compute time on a billion-dollar cluster creates astronomical value. That 5% to 8% premium they charge for schedule assurance suddenly looks incredibly cheap.
It fundamentally alters the value proposition. It goes from a vendor relationship to a strategic partnership. Plus, the cross-selling synergies mapped out in the research are exceptionally clean.
Oh, absolutely. Sterling has deeply entrenched multi-year relationships with the major hyperscalers building data centers. They can now walk into those procurement offices and confidently offer CEC's advanced electrical services.
And the pipeline flows both ways, right? Because over 80% of CEC's historical revenue comes from mission-critical markets, but their absolute sweet spot has been semiconductor fabrication plants.
Right. They are deeply embedded with clients like Intel, Samsung, and Texas Instruments. So now CEC can introduce Sterling's massive site prep capabilities to those semiconductor mega projects.
Incredible. But, you know, as an institutional investor, translating this operational narrative into the financial models requires navigating a few specific nuances, particularly around how the company reports its future revenue visibility. Let's dig into the 10K, because if you run a standard screen and look purely at Sterling's reported e-infrastructure backlog, you are going to get a severely distorted picture of their actual runway.
Yes, we need to talk about the backlog illusion.
The backlog illusion, I love that term.
This was a really critical piece of nuance detailed in the AlphaSense interviews. Traditional backlog metrics, which measure signed, funded contracts, are structurally misleading for this specific end market.
How so?
Well, when a hyperscaler acquires land for a massive data center campus, they might have a multi-billion-dollar master plan intended to roll out over 5 to 7 years. But they do not sign a single massive contract for all the site prep up front.
Yeah, because the technology curve is moving too fast, right? They have no idea what the thermodynamics or liquid cooling requirements for phase four will be. The silicon powering phase four hasn't even been taped out at the foundry yet.
Precisely. Because of that technological uncertainty, the hyperscaler awards the site prep work to Sterling in discrete, bite-sized chunks, typically $25 million to $50 million at a time, corresponding to specific phases of the build.
Ah, so Sterling's officially reported backlog only captures the specific chunk that is currently signed and active.
Exactly. It completely ignores the fact that Sterling's bulldozers are already on the ground for a multi-year campus build-out. It severely understates the cash flow visibility.
And management has explicitly stated they're tracking a pipeline of unqualified backlog future phase opportunities on existing sites where they are already the incumbent that stretches out to 2028 and 2030.
Right. The reported backlog is just the tip of the spear. But of course, models demand a sober assessment of the downside, and the sources highlight several vulnerabilities that require monitoring. The most immediate operational constraint is labor.
Right, because Sterling's entire schedule assurance moat relies on deploying the absolute best heavy equipment operators and engineering crews. To scale up fast enough to meet hyperscaler demand, they are forced to pay premium wages.
And in a structurally tight skilled labor market, that presents a real risk of margin compression. Now, they've demonstrated the pricing power to pass those labor costs through to the hyperscaler so far, but it requires constant vigilance.
Makes sense. And beyond e-infrastructure, we have to look at the remaining 40% of the business.
Yeah, the building solutions segment makes up about 20% of sales. This division is highly exposed to pouring residential concrete slabs. The analyst notes indicate that while the Houston market remains robust, Dallas has been surprisingly soft.
Yeah, the Dallas weakness is a combination of macroeconomic housing affordability issues and adverse weather patterns delaying starts. It's a good reminder that not everything they do is insulated from standard economic cycles.
Exactly. And finally, transportation solutions still accounts for roughly 38% of the top line. This segment is currently heavily supported by the $1.2 trillion IIJA infrastructure bill, and they have successfully transitioned the mix away from low-bid highways toward aviation infrastructure and alternative delivery rail and bridge projects.
Which is much better, but any fixed-price government contract inherently carries inflation and execution risk. If the cost of cement or specialized steel spikes 40% unexpectedly, and the contract doesn't have a robust escalation clause, those margins will feel the pinch.
That's just the structural reality of public infrastructure work. It is. But the vital takeaway for a buy-side model is the portfolio effect. The unprecedented pricing power and margin profile Sterling commands in the e-infrastructure segment provides an unusually thick margin of safety for the overall enterprise.
The premium they earn from big tech creates a financial buffer that traditional E&C firms simply do not possess.
Exactly.
So pulling all the threads together, the transformation is staggering. A decade ago, they were bleeding cash, fighting for scraps in the lowest common denominator highway market. Today, they have ruthlessly pruned the toxic revenue, leaned entirely into complex logistical execution, and engineered a vertically integrated schedule-assuring monopoly in the mega project space.
Management realized the market no longer rewarded the cheapest dirt mover. The massive premium was reserved for the most reliable infrastructure partner. And buying CEC wasn't just about adding revenue, it was about buying absolute control over the critical path of the project timeline.
It's a masterclass in reading the macroeconomic tea leaves and aggressively aligning capital to the bottlenecks. But as you stress test your terminal value assumptions, I want to leave you with one final thought.
Okay.
Today, every model is dominated by the AI data center build-out and the reshoring of semiconductor fabs. It is a generational supercycle. But let's look past this cycle. Let's say we reach the early 2030s and the hyperscaler land grab finally begins to plateau.
Right. Well, the core advantage of fungibility remains intact.
Exactly. Because the United States is staring down the barrel of a massive, unavoidable crisis in aging water infrastructure and a desperate need for next generation power generation, whether that is a renaissance in nuclear facilities, massively upgraded grid infrastructure, or utility scale renewables.
And the physical reality of fixing those national systems requires moving mountains.
Yes. When those multi-trillion-dollar capital spigots inevitably open in the 2030s, who do you think owns the massive fleet of bulldozers, the unassailable capital scale, the integrated electrical capabilities, and the flawless safety records required to clear the land and lay the literal groundwork?
Who else can even qualify to bid on it?
Exactly. As you look at the long-term compounding potential of this platform, remember they aren't just an AI derivative. They are the physical foundation for whatever critical infrastructure the economy demands next.
The financial X-ray of this company used to reveal a very broken, murky model. Today, the structural integrity and the path to sustained free cash flow generation are incredibly clear.
And that is the signal in the noise. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the underlying mechanics of Sterling Infrastructure. We'll catch you next time.